And this is how the Americans managed to create this fear among the Arabs, to tell them that the Iranians have are expansionists, and they are expanding to other countries, and they will come and take your country. It is not possible, because this is only a fool person can believe that, because the Americans tried to occupy Afghanistan, and they have 1,800,000 soldiers, and they failed. They tried to occupy Iraq, and they have failed. They tried to occupy Syria. Again, they failed. They went to, with the multinational forces in the 80s in Lebanon, and they were kicked out. So no country can go and invade another country and be able to occupy the entire country and stay there forever. So this Iranian phobia has been also used by the Gulf country leaders to support the Americans and buy their weapons, so they can keep the danger of the American away from them.
Thank you, Sayed Mohsen Abbas from London, there, journalist and political commentator. Elijah Magnier, thank you so much. From Marseille, France, journalist and political analyst. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Tahway and the team, it's goodbye until next time.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. Here we enlighten you with ayahs 261 and 262 from the Surah Baqarah, recited by Ali Parhiskar.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. مَثَلُ الَّذِينَ يُنْفِقُونَ أَمْوَالَهُمْ فِي سَبِيلِ اللَّهِ كَمَثَلِ حَبَّةٍ أَنْبَتَتْ سَبْعَ سَنَابِلَ كَمَثَلِ حَبَّةٍ أَنْبَتَتْ سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم مثل الذين ينفقون سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى لهم أجرهم عند ربهم ولا خوف عليهم ولا هم يحزنون صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most compassionate. The parable of those who spend their property in the way of Allah is as the parable of the grain growing 7 years, with 100 grains in every year. And Allah multiplies for whom He pleases, and Allah is ample giving, knowing. As for those who spend their property in the way of Allah, then do not follow what they have spent with reproach or injury. They shall have their reward from their Lord, and they shall have no fear, nor shall they grieve.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
This hour, the UK is mourning the death of its longest-reigning monarch amid calls in former Caribbean colonies to remove the British sovereign as their head of state. Tehran says Washington's latest sanctions show the U.S. is behind the false scenario accusing Iran of conducting cyber attacks against Albania. And the U.S. says it has no hostile intent towards North Korea in reaction to Pyongyang's new law allowing the use of preemptive nuclear strikes. Thank you for joining us. Top story this hour, global reverberations continue following the passing of Britain's longest-serving monarch, Queen Elizabeth II, at the age of 96 after 7 years on the throne. Britain's new monarch, King Charles III, made his first public appearance to address the nation and thank well-wishers. With a state funeral planned followed by coronation ceremony, Amina Taylor looked ahead to the challenges facing the new king.
Britain has a new monarch. King Charles III used his first address to the nation since taking the throne to pay tribute to his late mother.
Queen Elizabeth was a life well lived, a promise with destiny kept. And she is mourned most deeply in her passing. That promise of lifelong service I renew to you all today.
Earlier, the new king, alongside Queen Consort Camilla, met well wishers gathered outside Buckingham Palace, paying their respects after the passing of Queen Elizabeth II on Thursday. Gun salutes, floral tributes, and flags flying at half-mast symbolize the country in the first phase of an official 12-day mourning period. Messages of condolences flooded in from world leaders, with domestic tributes being led in the House of Commons by the new Prime Minister, Liz Truss.
Today, we show the world that we do not fear what lies ahead. We send our deepest sympathy to all members of the royal family. We pay tribute to our late Queen, and we offer loyal service to our new King.
These are unprecedented times, and the parliamentarians will be getting used to saying God save the King instead of God save the Queen. But what will a monarchy under the stewardship of Charles III really look like? Charles's ascension to the throne comes following a 7-decade-long reign by the late monarch.
Lots of people who maybe were not great fans of the monarchy as an institution respected Queen Elizabeth II for her longevity, for her record. They forgot many of the things that she was also associated with, the end of empire, which is often very brutal in places like Kenya. But they gave her some respect, and you'll see that, I think, over the next 12 days. You'll see people prepared to give that respect to the Queen. I think it's going to be a very different story going down the road, and we should remember that the monarchy is very important to the British elite. The armed forces, the security services, judiciary, they swear loyalty not to Parliament, but to the monarchy.
Charles's new role as king comes at not just a tumultuous time for the throne, but for the country itself.
If he's going to be an effective king, he will have to speak to the nation in a way that brings people together. And that may involve him, and as Charles has known to do this in the past, be a very much more politically overly political monarch than some of his predecessors. He's made interventions on various issues, and I think he'll continue to do that going forward.
At home and abroad, there'll be questions about what Britain's new monarch's vision will be. Will the tentacles of the new reign bring forth a new dawn? Former subjects across the world will simply wait and see. Amina Taylor, London.
Calls are growing in former colonies in the Caribbean to remove the British monarch as their head of state. That after the ascension of Charles to the UK throne after the death of her mother, Queen Elizabeth II. Some Commonwealth leaders have expressed unease about the passage of leadership from Elizabeth to Charles. There are doubts about the role a distant monarch should play in the 21st century. In Jamaica and the Bahamas, people are calling for reparation and an apology for slavery. This is why Barbados, one of a dozen Caribbean nations which are Commonwealth members, ditched the Queen as head of state last year. Jamaica has signaled it may follow suit. A survey shows 56% of Jamaicans favor removing the British monarch as the head of state. Activists in the region also argue that Charles' accession is an opportunity to redouble calls for slavery reparations. Journalist and political commentator Syed Mohsen Abbas joined us earlier to tell us more about the challenges that a new British monarch will face after ascending to the throne.
Charles is really getting on in age, and you don't know me, that this family has quite an age longevity, of course, as we know, but how long will his reign last? Will he be able to make that kind of impact? He's also, don't forget, now presiding over a very different kind of Britain that's emerging. What with all of the energy crisis and the world in flux as we see it around the globe today, Britain is also going to have to find its own way with the Brexit scenarios, with the relationships with China, America, etc., to balance the war in Ukraine. He's coming into a world which is probably equally fraught. I mean, the Queen herself came at the tail end of the Second World War, of course, and he's also going to have to deal with a complete change in the type of society that we're living in, the information age and the biotechnological age, the age of transhumanism, the age of, if you like, all sorts of modern technological advances will have its own challenges.
Ukraine's president says the country's forces have retaken control of dozens of towns as they push a counteroffensive against Russian forces in the northeast.
Up to now, the armed forces of Ukraine have liberated and took control of about 30 settlements in the Kharkiv region. In a number of villages in the area, activities to check and secure the territory are ongoing. Gradually, we take over new settlements. Everywhere, we return the Ukrainian flag and safety to our people.
Zelensky's comments follow reports that fierce battles are underway in Kharkiv region. Moscow has not confirmed any advances by the Ukrainian forces, but it says it's sending in more reinforcements to the area. Intense fighting is also raging in the south, where a Ukrainian counteroffensive is making progress in the Russian-held Kherson region. Meanwhile, Ukrainian officials say 8 people have been killed and over a dozen injured in attacks on a town in the eastern Donbas region. Russia has denied targeting civilians. A new report on poverty in France has revealed the devastating economic effects caused by Europe's sanctions on Russia over the Ukraine war. Multiple indicators have reached record lows, showing that their lower classes are worse off than in decades. Rami Mazoheri has more from Paris.
The annual report from one of France's top NGOs revealed that poverty has already skyrocketed this year. And that's at what many say is only the beginning of years of inflation and recession provoked by sanctions on Russia over the unrest in Ukraine. Secours Populaire found that the number of people who say they have known poverty has increased 9% in just the past year. That's the biggest increase in 30 years. This year, over 40% of France says they can't pay their transport, medical, energy, or childcare bills, or go on vacation, or even buy fruits and vegetables. It's the highest percentage they've ever recorded.
The poverty question in France is one that's been central, but the social safety net is running out. It's just going to get worse and worse for the poor people because they're not going to be able to afford this stuff, you know? And the French are not going to be able to subsidize these cost of living increases the way they did.
The steep increase in poverty comes after a decade of failed austerity policies and a deep devaluing of the euro currency. The government just announced they expect the next 2 economic quarters to produce a growth rate of 0.2% and then 0%. Many predict that the essentially recession-level economy will soon begin massive layoffs. That combination spells stagflation, and it's something for which liberal economics has no theoretical remedy. This adds to the feeling of unease, especially among the investor class and high finance.
France has a pretty good record of having a social safety net for those who are on bottom as far as health care is concerned and other basic necessities. But since Macron got elected, a lot of those things have changed because Macron has decided that he's going to attack that social safety net.
The report showed that a near universal 85% of France is worried for the future generations. That's also the highest percentage ever recorded. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Iran has roundly condemned the United States' imposition of sanctions against the Iranian Ministry of Intelligence and its minister. Foreign Ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani said Washington's new bans, like its previous illegal sanctions, will not be able to stop Iranian authorities' will to serve the nation. He said the United States' support for Albania's baseless accusation against Iran is a clear proof that the White House itself was behind the whole scenario and that Tehran had fallen victim to Washington's move. Tehran's reaction came after Washington imposed sanctions on Iran's intelligence minister over alleged cyber attacks against Albania, which is a U.S. ally. Iran has dismissed the charges, saying the Islamic Republic itself has been a victim of cyber attacks. Relations between Iran and Albania have been tense since the Balkan nation provided a safe haven for the anti-Iran terrorist group, MKO. We have talked to a historian and social activist, Ulsi Jazeshi, about Albania's decision to ties with Iran. He believes the U.S. and Israel are behind Tehran's anti-Tehran position. Take a listen.
Albania has become a hostile country to Iran since 2016, when it was ordered by the Americans to host the terrorist organization of Mujahideen al-Halk. Since their location to Albania, the Mujahideens, they have carried numerous cyber attacks and propaganda attacks and maybe even terrorist attacks against the Islamic Republic. These attacks, which go contrary to the penal code of Albania, have gone unpunished. The Albanian government learns about this, but they are afraid from the Americans to act. The Mujahideens are used in Albania by Israel, and if you see the Israeli media today and yesterday, they are very happy with what Prime Minister Edi Rama is doing. So the latest attack against Iran most probably was coordinated with Israel, but very surprisingly, we had even the American and the British government, which in a way, they supported the extreme measure by Edi Rama.
North Korea is facing criticism from several countries as well as the United Nations for declaring itself a nuclear weapons state. The UN chief has expressed deep concern over the North's new law enshrining the right to use preemptive nuclear strikes. Antonio Guterres has urged Pyongyang to resume talks to achieve sustainable peace. France has also condemned the law as a threat to international and regional peace and security. Paris says North Korea's aggressive declaration effectively eliminates the possibility of denuclearization talks. However, the U.S. has reacted cautiously, saying it has no hostile intent toward the North and continues to seek diplomacy. North Korea has officially enshrined the right to use nuclear weapons to protect itself. The North Korean leader has described the law as irreversible. The country is already under international sanctions over its nuclear and missile programs. Political analyst Chin Do-shu says North Korea feels threatened by the U.S. military presence in South Korea, and that's the reason Pyongyang says it reserves the right to defend itself in case of a potential attack or invasion.
So when the United States talk about a threat from North Korea, people in the West often ignore the fact that North Korea feels threatened by the United States, by the presence of U.S. military forces in the soil of South Korea, remember. And also sometimes the U.S. will fly in, for example, B-52. That's a lethal force, obviously. I would say a real threat to the sovereignty and the security of North Korea. So both sides feel the threat from each other. They need to sit down and talk about their security issue and then move forward of building a normal country-to-country relationship. But so far, what we have seen is, you know, in Seoul, there's a new government which has given up the previous practice of engaging North Korea or sanction policy in the sense that it's more engagement with North Korea, and so they can build a peaceful and stable relationship or stability in the Korean Peninsula.
The United Nations has made an international appeal for aid to Pakistan. The country has been dealing with more than 2 months of destructive flooding triggered by monsoon rains. The UN chief says Pakistan's losses stand at over $30 billion. Nasser Kazmi has the details.
The UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has arrived in Pakistan to see climate-induced devastation from months of deadly record floods that have left 500,000 people living in tents under the open sky and have left nearly 1,400 deaths. During his visit, the UN chief and Pakistan's Prime Minister Shehbaz Sharif discussed the latest situation in the country. The two focused on joint efforts to carry out relief, rescue, and rehabilitation at the international level to mitigate the sufferings of the flood-affected people. Later, the visiting UN chief also met Pakistan's Foreign Minister Bilawal Bhutto Zardari and assured him of every support possible. The UN Secretary General, who has launched a global appeal to raise $160 million in flood assistance for Pakistan, says Pakistan is one of the countries most affected by climate change in recent months.
Developed countries must step up and provide Pakistan and other countries on the front lines with the financial and technical resources they need to survive extreme weather events like these deadly floods.
Bhutto said that his government is trying its best to help people who had lost everything in floods, but international help would be required to overcome the catastrophe.
I cannot shelter 33 million families. I cannot provide the food and clothing for 35 million families. We don't have the infrastructure in place. And this is just the rescue and relief phase.
The UN chief will travel to areas most impacted by the climate catastrophe. He will interact with the displaced families and oversee the UN's humanitarian response and relief efforts for millions of affected people. As the floods continue to ravage Pakistan, UN agencies and several countries continue to send aid to flood-affected people in recent weeks. However, Pakistani authorities believe that more assistance is required to help millions of flood victims. Nasir Kazmi in Islamabad.
Well, that's your world news for now. Stay tuned.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Supplication on Saturdays. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Bismillah, words that seekers of sanctuary repeatedly recite. Words that the very cautious in search of protection often repeat. I seek refuge with Allah, the Exalted above all. From the oppression of the unjust, from the deceitful malice the envious use to lay snares and traps, from the injustice and outrage of the tyrants, and I sing his praise. Do better and go beyond other praisers. O Allah, thou art one, has no partner, and is the Lord Master without being made. There is no discrepancy or nonsense in thy commands, nor there is lawlessness in thy kingdom. I beseech thee to send blessings on Muhammad, thy servant, thy messenger. To let me ask thee for enlightenment and inspiration, so as to be thankful for thy bounties, which alone get thy approval ultimately. To help me to obey thee, and instinctively worship thee, and make me deserve thy rewards on account of thy very patronage. And have mercy on me, and prevent me from breaking in the bounds of thy prohibitions, as far as I am kept alive, and show the way unto that which is useful and advantageous till I go on survive. To let me take to heart the meanings of thy book, and by its reading, throw down the heavy burden of sins, and receive welfare and salvation as a gift. Let not my family and friends who love me leave me alone. Let thy favors reach me in abundance during the remainder of my life, exactly as they used to be made available for me in full in the days gone by. O the Most Merciful.
In the limelight.
It was quite clear from day one that the Zionist regime military would not practice justice for the murder of Palestinian journalist Shirin Abu Aqileh on May 11th of this year. What comes to mind is that how many times the fabricated regime of Israel has ever practiced justice, and how can you expect from an apartheid regime who brazenly steals land and kills innocent people to practice justice? These are the questions that need to be answered by the Zionist regime's allies and aides, the U.S. in particular. In this regard, we have taken a look at the world media for further details. This is the second part. The website of Common Dreams, penned by Juan Cole, author, wrote, "The Israeli military issued a brazen whitewash of its killing of Palestinian-American journalist Shirin Abu Aqileh and its shooting of her colleague, Al Jazeera producer Ali Samoudi, on May 11th of this year. Using whistle words, the report admitted that it was likely that an Israeli sniper shot her dead. Since extensive video and eyewitness evidence proves that there was no militants in the area at the time of her killing, CNN had already concluded after an extensive investigation that the Israeli military killed Shirin in a targeted attack. Shirin's colleague, Shatha Hanaisha, told CNN, "We stood in front of the Israeli military vehicles for about 5 to 10 minutes before we made moves to ensure they saw us. And this was a habit of ours as journalists. We move as a group and we stand in front of them so they know we are journalists. Then we start moving." Video taken at the scene and reviewed by CNN showed there was no gunfire and there were no clashes that could have provoked the Israeli sniper. The journalists were in full view of the Israeli military and had waved at the soldiers and drawn attention to their press jackets. The Israeli sniper fired in a targeted way and over again, suddenly and without provocation. The sniper could have been under orders to take out the Al Jazeera journalists who were covering an Israeli army raid on Palestinian territory, a raid that may have been anticipated to involve Israeli actions that the army was unwilling to see documented. That is just as killing civilians through reckless disregard for their lives and killing even though the shooter should have known the risk to civilian life are war crimes. So the killing of a journalist such as Abu Aqileh under similar conditions is a war crime. Since the Israeli regime has now admitted the high likelihood that its sniper killed Shirin, surely it will now treat the killing as a form of manslaughter. At the very least, and punish the sniper? No, it won't. But surely it will pay reparations to Shirin's family? No, it won't. Surely the Biden administration will intervene to ensure justice is done for the American citizen like Shirin? No, it won't. The whole affair signals once again Washington's commitment to awarding the Israeli impunity for such killings, even of American Christians.
The website of Al Jazeera English also wrote, Israel says it will not launch a criminal investigation into the killing of Al Jazeera journalist who was shot in the head. Multiple detailed investigations, including by the United Nations, the Palestinian Authority, and several media outlets, including CNN and the Associated Press News Agency, found that Abu Aqila was definitively shot by Israeli fire and that there were no Palestinian fighters at the scene when she was killed. The journalists who were standing next to her and witnessed the killing also said no Palestinians were present. Palestinian eyewitnesses told Al Jazeera's The Take podcast that they were never contacted by Israel as part of the investigation. In a statement recently, Abu Aqila's family said Israel tried to obscure the truth and avoid responsibility for killing Shirin Abu Aqila. As expected, Israel has refused to take responsibility for murdering Shirin. Her family is not surprised by this outcome, since it's obvious to anyone the Israeli war criminals cannot investigate their own crimes, the statement read. According to Al Jazeera, in a statement following the Zionist regime's announcement, the U.S. State Department again stressed the need for accountability, describing Abu Aqila as a fearless reporter who had earned the respect of audiences around the world. We welcome Israel's review of this tragic incident and again underscore the importance of accountability in this case, such as policies and procedures to prevent similar incidents from occurring in the future, the statement said. Al Jazeera has condemned the Israeli occupation forces' attempt to evade responsibility for Abu Aqila's killing. Al Jazeera Media Network denounces the findings of this investigation and stresses that this elusive admission is nothing but an attempt from the IOF to evade the criminal responsibility for the killing of Shirin, which has been proven by numerous independent and international investigations. The Qatar-based TV network said in a statement recently.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Real Royals. Part 1.
The British royal family, an institution instantaneously recognizable throughout the world. Positioning itself as both the face and heart of Britain, the monarchy purports to perform a dual role. Promote British interests on the global stage, and at the same time sustain and justify its own institutional relevance. The royal family sets out to perform these apparently complementary roles by projecting a carefully crafted and jealously guarded image of propriety, diligence, and unflinching pursuit of duty. To that end, the British monarchy goes to extraordinary lengths to discourage, distract, and disrupt any real scrutiny of its true role and performance. But keeping up appearances is not always an easy task. The recent controversy surrounding the estrangement of Prince Harry and his wife Meghan Markle is just the latest of a long line of scandals engulfing the royal family in the past three decades. Much to the Queen's dismay, the so-called Harry and Meghan saga has depicted the royal family in a poor light. The most serious charge relating to allegations of racism, initially directed at Meghan Markle, whose mother is African-American, and then more ominously towards her baby. As Meghan Markle recounted to Oprah Winfrey in the now famous interview in March 2021, an anonymous senior member of the royal family was concerned how brown her baby was going to be. There was widespread speculation that the anonymous racist at the top of the royal family was none other than the new deceased Duke of Edinburgh, husband to Queen Elizabeth for 74 years. The notorious escapades of Princess Diana, wherein the estranged wife of Prince Charles engaged in multiple extramarital affairs, was arguably the first time in modern times that the carefully managed moral reputation of the British royal family was shattered in front of a global audience. Similar to Meghan Markle, the late Princess Diana informed the world of her pain and anguish through a hard-hitting interview with BBC Panorama in November 1995. The description that Diana provided of the royal family nearly three decades ago is eerily similar to its recent depiction by Meghan Markle. Both accounts present the British monarchy as a cold, distant, and unfeeling organization, which not only demands total obedience from its members, but by extension, it goes to extreme lengths to discredit those who are perceived to have broken the rules. Both Diana and Meghan are perceived to have broken the rules, and very quickly, the two women were ostracized and cast as outsiders. Diana would ultimately pay with her life for daring to criticize and expose the royals. And as for Meghan Markle, it remains to be seen what fate awaits her. For if Mohammed Al-Fayed, the billionaire father of Princess Diana's late lover, Dodi Fayed, is to be believed, Princess Diana, alongside her lover Dodi, was murdered by the British Secret Service, MI6, on the instructions of the monarchy. The allegations could be dismissed as a conspiracy theory, was the only one making them, but he is not. Even former MI6 officers have made the same allegations, and in the process, supplying credible details to support their incendiary claims. It is now widely suspected that Henry Paul, the deputy head of secretary at Ritz Hotel in Paris, who was driving Diana and her lover Dodi on that fateful late August night, was a long-standing MI6 agent. If indeed the Queen had given a nod and a wink to her Secret Service to deal decisively with the increasingly troublesome Diana, then there was a much bigger message conveyed by that suspected murder. You cross the British monarchy at your own peril.
Your Majesty's guard is ready to march off, ma'am.
To gauge the extent the Queen will go to protect her interests, the best place to start is the great name change of 1917, which enabled the British monarchy to conceal its German roots. By all credible accounts, the great majority of the British people are unaware of the distant roots of the monarchy. Since the accession of Queen Elizabeth II to the throne in 1952, the British establishment has tried hard to depict the monarchy as a quintessentially British institution. However, the reality is very different. The name change from Saxe-Coburg-Gotha to Windsor was effected by King George V at the height of World War I, at a time when the British public were understandably alienated by German names. From this cynical name change, it can be deducted that there is nothing uniquely British about the royal family. Therefore, Tony Blair's assertion that the Queen and her entourage represent continuity in British public life is yet another cynical deception perpetrated against the British people. The Queen may project an image of quintessential Britishness, but it is doubtful that deep down she still doesn't feel a fondness for Germany, not necessarily contemporary liberal Germany, but the Germany of old, specifically the Teutonic way of life of the 19th century. Let's not forget that the longest reigning British monarch, Queen Victoria, who ruled for nearly 64 years, died in the arms of a German emperor, Kaiser Wilhelm II. Who, astonishingly enough, was her grandson on the Isle of Wight in 1901.
As a child, I never imagined that one day a man would walk on the moon.
The royal family reportedly continues to celebrate Christmas the German way by opening presents after afternoon tea on Christmas Eve, which falls on December 24th. By contrast, the British people open presents on Christmas morning, December 25th, typically before breakfast. Although these quirks might be dismissed on the grounds of sentimentalism and nostalgia, but the story gets much more sinister. Britain's shortest reigning monarch, Edward VIII, whose 11th-month reign in 1936 coincided with the policy of appeasement towards Nazi Germany, is a case in point. Edward was well known for his pro-German political sympathies. "Every drop of blood in my veins is German," Edward VIII is reported to have boasted to pro-German activist Diana Mitford, arguably the most accomplished of the notorious Mitford sisters and the then wife of British fascist leader Sir Oswald Mosley. Germany's ambassador to the court of St. James's, the prominent Nazi Joachim von Ribbentrop, who was German foreign minister throughout World War II, even called Edward V half-German on account of the king's effusive pro-German sympathies, if not his mastery of the German language and cultural mores. Indeed, Edward VIII was no ordinary appeaser, insofar as he actively supported the German cause in the 1930s. His support for Nazi Germany started very early, no later than the foundation of the Nazi regime in 1933, when, as Prince Edward, he encouraged the young princesses, Margaret and Elizabeth, to give Nazi salutes while on a visit to Germany. It is equally noteworthy that, like his brother before him, King George VI was an admirer of Hitler and the Nazis, and an active supporter of the policy of appeasement, which historians blame for the outbreak of war in Europe in September 1939. It has often been said that had Edward VIII been an ordinary citizen, he would most likely have been charged with his treason and swiftly executed following the conclusion of World War II in Europe in May 1945. Another element of Britishness is, without doubt, the Treason Act of 1351, one of the oldest pieces of legislation still on the statute books. At the same time, this ancient law is emblematic of the royal family's disregard, if not contempt, for the body of ancient English laws which it claims to uphold. One quirk of this ancient law is that it constitutes high treason to violate the wife of the king's eldest son, or in contemporary terms, the queen's son, which in this case happens to be Prince Charles. Based on this law, multiple prosecutions could have been launched against the various men, notably Army Major James Hewitt, who entered into consensual romantic and sexual liaisons with the late Princess Diana, the wife to heir apparent to the throne, Prince Charles. Despite her widespread popular appeal, Princess Diana was known to be promiscuous and had affairs with multiple men, including James Gilby, the heir to a large gin fortune, Etonian art dealer Oliver Hoare, rugby player Will Carling, the Pakistani heart and lung surgeon Hasnat Khan. There were even rumors she had an affair with John Kennedy Jr., the late son of John F. Kennedy. Incidentally, until 1814, the penalty for high treason was death by hanging, drawing and quartering, thereafter reduced to death by hanging. Ignoring the Treason Act indicates that the British monarchy is more than willing and able to engage in legal manoeuvrings, even to the extent of seriously compromising the rich tapestry of ancient and modern laws and norms which underpin the UK's unwritten constitution in order to stay afloat. The Princess Diana saga, which only concluded with her untimely death in 1997, is just one example amongst many. Prince Andrew is yet another and much more contemporaneous example. The errant prince is wanted in the US for questioning in relation to the Jeffrey Epstein scandal, which saw multiple underage girls abused by the deceased American financier. Prince Andrew, or until very recently the Duke of York to give him his formal royal title, was a close confidant of the American paedophile Jeffrey Epstein, who chose to commit suicide in a lonely prison cell instead of facing the music for his shocking crimes. The Duke of York abused his royal privilege for more than 2 years to avoid accountability in a formal setting, and all the while the Queen said nothing about the whole sordid affair, before she finally caved in to public pressure and stripped her son of all titles and charities. But then again, Prince Andrew has form when it comes to corruption and scandal. Dubbed Air Miles Andy on account of his extravagant billing arrangements, it is reported that in 2003 alone, he racked up £325,000 flying around the world, including using a helicopter to fly to Oxford and misusing RAF planes to fly to Scotland to play golf. To make matters worse, his former wife, the scandal-prone Sarah Ferguson, caused deep embarrassment to the Queen when she was exposed by a News of the World sting operation in 2010, in which she promised to arrange access to Prince Andrew, who was then the UK's special trade envoy, in exchange for £500,000 in cash. If the royal family has struggled with issues of nationality and political allegiance, it could be said they have an easier relationship with religion and religious identity. Easier in the sense that the Act of Settlement 1701, whose cardinal aim was to ensure a Protestant succession to the English throne, places a prohibition on Catholics ascending to the crown as kings or queens. Astonishingly, this act is still religiously adhered to, and the British monarch is presented as defender of the faith, as in Protestantism. But the offence and discrimination this act inflicts is no longer limited to Roman Catholics, as the demographic and cultural diversity of Britain has hugely expanded since the early 1950s. Modern Britain is home to millions of people of non-Christian backgrounds, notably Muslims and Hindus. Since the early 1980s, the British government, in tandem with large business organisations and civil society writ large, has gone out of its way to place diversity at the pivot of its domestic policies. This attitude has given rise to an idiosyncratic British concept of multiculturalism, which purports to promote equality of opportunity amongst the UK's diverse demographic groups. But is the Queen's status of defender of the faith consistent with this policy? More broadly, the religious issue, although highly symbolic, is just one example among many where the Queen is seriously out of step with developments in British society. To properly integrate this disparity in world values in British society, the best place to start is the political realm. The UK likes to project itself as the world's oldest democracy, taking special pride in its parliamentary roots.
Hundreds of respondents took part in the Stoke-on-Trent.
Supporters of the British establishment never tire of reminding the world that their core parliament, the House of Commons, is the oldest such institution in the world.
To serve as a teacher. Yay!
This is a myth, of course, as there are many ancient parliaments out there, such as the Swedish Parliament or the Riksdag, some of which predate the House of Commons by decades and even centuries. Pedantic disputes aside, the modern House of Commons is generally recognised as a democratic institution, as demonstrated by the rigorous section and election processes, which take place before someone from whichever political party takes up his or her place in Parliament. And yet these very same people have to not only swear an oath of allegiance to an unelected monarch, but worse still, throughout their tenure, they are forced to demonstrate defence to the royal family, often against their own best judgment. At least for the past 120 years, there have been professed Republicans who are against the monarchy establishment in the House of Commons and, lesser still, in the House of Lords. There are not many of them, but the fact they are there and are forced to swear an oath of allegiance to the Queen introduces a degree of hypocrisy into the British political process.
I swear by Almighty God that I will be faithful and bear true allegiance to Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth, her heirs and successors according to law.
Worse still, the fact that MPs are forced to swear an oath of allegiance to the Queen is the strongest indicator that all legal and constitutional means for removing the Queen and the royal family have been closed off. Short of a revolution, the British people simply cannot overthrow their unelected rulers. The Queen, of course, does not reciprocate in kind, insofar as she does not swear an oath to uphold parliamentary democracy, let alone serving the people. But the real picture is much worse than that, inasmuch as every major British institution, from the military down to the prison system, is trapped in this unreciprocated oath of allegiance. On account of this comprehensive hegemony, how can stalwarts of the British establishment claim the Queen is bereft of political power and yet keep a straight face at the same time? At this juncture, it is necessary to gauge an accurate picture of the extent of the Queen's powers. Just how powerful is she, and to what extent can the monarchy affect the tide of British destiny? The simple answer, of course, is that the Queen and her heirs have tremendous powers, which affect the daily lives of Britons and, to a lesser extent, the citizens of those countries where the Queen is still nominally head of state, notably Canada, Australia, and New Zealand. In keeping with British tradition, where subtlety and discretion are prized characteristics, the monarchy exercises political power through ancient and seemingly innocuous-sounding institutions. One such institution is the Privy Council, officially a body comprised of senior politicians whose job is to advise the Queen on the exercise of the royal prerogative. For one thing, the Privy Council remains a secretive arm of the state, with a set of traditions and rituals that come close to Masonic theatrics. And at the center of its official business is the Queen herself, who is physically present every time the Council meets to utter the words approved or referred in order to direct or influence policy proposals. In short, the Privy Council constitutes the principal vehicle by which the royal prerogative is enforced. In the words of the former Liberal Democrat MP turned establishment critic, Norman Baker, the Privy Council is effectively a one-person law-making, decision-taking machine. The royal prerogative, whose spirit and functions are embodied in the Privy Council, has multiple layers, with each layer in turn producing multiple, if not countless, powers and privileges. For instance, the prerogative of perfection is a function which confers personal immunity on the sovereign from ever being sued in the courts. The Queen is quite literally above the law. If the Privy Council represents the hard edge of the Queen's far-reaching powers, then the honours system constitutes the soft core of her barely concealed, all-encompassing influence. Going back all the way to 1348, with the establishment of the Order of Chivalry against the backdrop of the Black Death Plague, Britain's honours system enables the Queen to maintain the country's social and economic hierarchy. By doling out honours, indirectly by way of the government, the Queen confers favours and recognition to those whom she approves of. Officially designed to distinguish between different degrees of achievement and service, the honours system actually performs the opposite by conferring recognition on those the establishment, and by extension the Queen, seeks to promote and elevate. But the honours system, like every feature of British public life, is vulnerable to deep corruption. In the Cash for Honours scandal of 2006 to 2007, for instance, honours and peerages for the House of Lords were offered to individuals who had made large financial donations to the then ruling Labour Party.
Soleimani high-speed craft military catamaran, symbol of innovation in shipbuilding technology. The importance of a powerful and efficient navy for the Islamic Republic of Iran is undeniable, given that Iran has a very long sea borders, both in the south and in the north, and given Iran's geostrategic position in the Persian Gulf. In view of the fact that Iran has been subjected to an arms embargo for the past several decades, it is no surprise that Iran's shipbuilding industry, maritime industries, and self-sufficiency initiative of the IRGC naval forces are all geared towards producing military vessels and submarines capable of satisfying the needs of the Iranian Navy and bolstering Iran's naval capabilities. Please stay with us for more details of the Shahid Soleimani high-speed craft military catamaran. The IRGC naval forces, which was established in the middle of the 8-year imposed war on Iran in the 1980s, gradually managed to build modern ships and modern submarines and military hardware for the IRGC Navy, using the most up-to-date and cutting-edge technology in the world. These logistical and military vessels have all been equipped with home-developed Iranian military hardware and weapon systems, which are able to compete on a global level. The IRGC naval forces have traditionally relied on a variety of speedboats fitted with torpedoes, mines, machine guns, rockets and missiles, depending on the task that they tried to accomplish, or the mission that was set for them. These speedboats have helped the IRGC Navy to secure Iran's southern waters in the Persian Gulf and the Sea of Oman. But in more recent years, a fundamental change in innovation has occurred in Iran's shipbuilding industry, with a variety of catamarans being manufactured for the first time by Iran's maritime industries and IRGC naval forces. But what is a catamaran? A catamaran is a multi-hulled watercraft featuring two parallel hulls of equal size.